Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting stories from around the world. To make it easier for you if you are learning American English, we always speak a little bit more slowly than normal, and we try to use words that are easy to understand. Today we have two stories for you. The first one is about women in leadership positions around the world. We think some of the numbers will surprise you. Then we are off to Vietnam. It is a country undergoing great change. We will hear about a new subway system that is underway in two of the country's main cities. It's time to listen and learn with the Voice of America as we bring you our world as it is. An international nonprofit group says women are increasingly serving as parliamentarians in a number of developing countries. The International Foundation for Electoral Systems says 26% of Iraq's parliament members are women. In Afghanistan, 28% of all lawmakers are women. And in Rwanda, the percentage is 64%. Yet the foundation says women continue to face barriers to the political process in many areas. The International Foundation for Electoral Systems says it supports citizens' rights to participate in free and fair elections. Jessica Huber is a gender specialist with the foundation, also known as the IFES. She says there is a link between conflict and what she called sustainable peace and democracy. She spoke at a gathering in Washington recently.
We can't say that conflict has started, conflict has ended, here's peace and here's democracy. We know that this is a murky continuum where we need to have women involved at the very beginning of this process.
Sheila Jackson Lee has represented the 18th Congressional District of Texas in the United States House of Representatives since 1995. She said that when women campaign for office, become active in politics, and are concerned about society, they have an effect on the world. But she noted when women gain power, some organizations feel threatened.
Like Malala, who was shot in the head as a 12-year-old because she wanted to go to school. Like Hillary Clinton, who's running for president. Like Benazir Bhutto, who I became a strong friend of and was saddened by the tragedy that came as she was running for president of Pakistan.
Pippa Norris is a professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. She says it is difficult for women to gain power. She says one way women can do so is through the use of quotas. By that, she means setting official limits on the number of women required in parliament or elected office.
What quotas do and what people have learnt is that where there's a window of opportunity for reform through a constitution or through the law or within a party, then you can really give what we term fast-track policies, fast-track change. And it's been remarkable in some countries how successful it's been by giving women a voice.
But critics say quotas are undemocratic. They say quotas hurt the principle of equal opportunity, because women are given a greater chance than men of winning office. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. If you were to visit Vietnam today, you might not recognize the place. There has been tremendous growth in the last few years. Public officials are now trying to build transportation systems in order to ease traffic and pollution problems. Mario Ritter has been examining the situation in the Southeast Asian nation and tells us what he has found.
Vietnam is developing quickly with skyscrapers and supermarkets. But the country still lacks one kind of public transportation that many countries of the world have, a subway system. After many years of delays and debates, Vietnam now seems committed to a subway. Construction on the underground train systems is taking place in Hanoi in the north and Ho Chi Minh City in the south. Vu Thi Hong Han is deputy head of the architecture department at Ho Chi Minh City University of Architecture. She says, because we are a developing country, we want to achieve what we think the developing world should have. Ms. Han is a consultant for the city government. She works on urban design around the subway stations. She says Vietnamese consider it a high-technology sign of progress. The Southeast Asian nation reached middle-income status in 2009. Per capita yearly income, a common measure of a nation's earning power, is now almost equal to $2,000. Vietnam's commuters are known for their dependence on motorbikes. They make up 80% of vehicles in Ho Chi Minh City. However, a recent university conference was asked to find out if that could be changed. Motorbikes are popular because they are cleaner and cheaper than cars, and they take up less space. People can easily do many tasks quickly, like getting groceries in the market or a phone card from a street vendor. People who support subways argue that planners should offer parking to combine private and public transportation. Some estimates say public transportation moves only 10% of commuters in Ho Chi Minh City. That could change with a subway. The project is receiving money from governments and other investors in Japan, Germany, Spain, and the Asian Development Bank. Transportation officials hope that a subway system will reduce congestion, pollution, and traffic deaths. The World Health Organization says road traffic injuries are the leading cause of death for those aged 15 to 29. It is estimated that there are 30 million motorbikes on Vietnam's roads. Pollution is another major concern for Vietnam. The country is industrializing, and that could create more gas emissions. Those gases warm the atmosphere and worsen climate change. Vietnam could suffer more than other countries from the effects of rising temperatures because it is low-lying and coastal. Nguyen Van Nam is with the Hanoi University of Transport and Communications. He believes Vietnam has 3 to 5 years before traffic and gridlock become truly severe. He said the economy needs efficient roads so workers do not waste time in long commutes. A subway is only part of the goal of better, cleaner transportation. Other suggestions include expanding bus service, making motorbikes run cleaner, increasing parking fees, and supporting bicycling and electric motorbikes. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Caffeine is the most widely used drug in the world. Many people drink coffee or tea to help them wake up in the morning. And many others drink caffeine throughout the day to prevent sleepiness. So it is no surprise that if you get too much caffeine before bedtime, it can keep you awake. It turns out that interrupting your sleep is bad for your health on many levels, including the cellular level. A new study explains how interrupted sleep can affect your mental and physical health. The study also explores how poor sleep can affect the cells in your body. Researchers from the United States and the United Kingdom have joined from across the pond to investigate this issue. They found that caffeinated drinks taken up to 3 hours before expected bedtime can delay normal sleep times by as much as 40 minutes. The amount of caffeine that disrupted sleep was equal to about 2 shots of espresso. Kenneth Wright is head of the Sleep and Chronobiology Laboratory at the University of Colorado Boulder. Mr. Wright warns some coffee drinks sold in coffee shops usually contain more caffeine than that. This is no surprise. Scientists have known for a long time that caffeine keeps you awake. Caffeine affects the chemicals in the brain that control wakefulness. Caffeine also blocks chemicals in the brain that promote or cause you to sleep. And interrupted sleep is not good for you. Not getting enough sleep can affect a person's mood. It also disrupts the body's natural sleep-wake cycle, called the circadian rhythm. Your body's circadian rhythm is found in cells throughout the entire body. So when caffeine disrupts your circadian rhythm, it affects hormone production and the regrowth of new cells in the human body. And this can play a role in many health problems, from obesity to diabetes to cancer. To look into caffeine's effect on the circadian rhythm, or circadian clock, researchers first noted the sleep-wake cycles of 5 healthy volunteers. The study lasted 49 days. Researchers gave the participants 200 milligrams of caffeine a few hours before bed. 200 milligrams of caffeine is about the amount found in 2 shots of espresso. Then the researchers noted how long it took the volunteers to fall asleep. The volunteers were also exposed at night to bright light, which is also known to disrupt sleep. Caffeine, however, interrupted the circadian clock and patterns of sleep more so than bright light did. Caffeine affects the production of melatonin, the sleep-producing hormone. When a person's circadian rhythm is disrupted, sleeping and eating patterns are thrown off. A disrupted circadian rhythm increases the chance of heart disease, obesity, and mental illnesses such as depression and bipolar disorder. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. Last week on our program, we talked about the presidency of John Tyler. The future of Texas was a major issue in American politics in the early 1840s. Texas had declared its independence from Mexico in 1836. Now some Americans wanted the new Republic of Texas to become a U.S. state. But others wanted Texas to remain independent. The Republic of Texas permitted slavery. Americans who opposed Texas statehood wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler wanted to make Texas a state. Tyler was a Southerner. He supported slavery and wanted Texas to keep the system legal. The president also had political reasons for wanting Texas to join the Union. He wanted to show that he increased the size and power of the United States during his presidency. He hoped Texas statehood would win him a nomination for a second term as president. So Tyler asked his new Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun, to negotiate the annexation of Texas. On April 12, 1844, Calhoun and Texas officials agreed the territory would enter the Union. They said the new state of Texas could continue slavery. But Britain objected. A British official sent a note saying that Britain wished to end slavery wherever it existed, including Texas. Secretary Calhoun's reply to Britain went public. He defended slavery in the American South. He said what was called slavery was really a political institution necessary for the peace, safety, and economic strength of those states where it existed. Ending slavery in Texas, he said, would be a danger to the American South and to the Union itself. Many people in northern states rejected Calhoun's reasoning. They called on their senators to vote against accepting Texas. But President Tyler continued with his effort to take control of Texas. He sent Calhoun's agreement with Texas to the U.S. Senate for approval. Soon after, the Whig Party opened its national convention to nominate a candidate for president. As expected, the Whigs did not choose President Tyler. They nominated Senator Henry Clay instead. Clay had been working hard to win the nomination. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention a month later. Many Democrats wanted former President Martin Van Buren to be their candidate. But the convention took a surprising turn. The Democrats approved a rule that a candidate must receive at least two-thirds of the votes to win. In the first vote, Van Buren won the most support, but not two-thirds. The convention delegates voted again, and again Van Buren fell short. The delegates kept voting, but Van Buren never earned the number of votes he needed. In fact, Van Buren began to lose votes. Other candidates were suggested, but none of them seemed able to win the necessary two-thirds either. Finally, someone proposed a new name, James Knox Polk.
James Polk was a very fascinating man, very hardworking. relentless in his pursuit of goals. He was not a particularly likable human being. He was somewhat suspicious of other people, but he had a way of figuring out what he needed to do to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, and he was very good at it, and that served him very well throughout his life.
Historian Robert Merry wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Merry says Polk did not come to the 1844 convention expecting to be nominated for president. At the time, Polk's political career was struggling. He had already served as the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Governor of Tennessee. He was well-respected and serious. But Polk had lost in his attempts to seek re-election as governor not once, but twice. Polk came to the Democrats' convention hoping to re-enter national politics and perhaps win the nomination for vice president. When the convention delegates voted on their presidential candidate for the eighth time, Polk received only 44 votes. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. Historian Robert Merry says James K. Polk became the first real political dark horse in American history. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win. One reason he did was Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading Democratic candidate, Martin Van Buren, did not think so. Neither did the Whig candidate, Henry Clay. Van Buren and Clay believed that annexation of Texas could lead to a war with Mexico, and they were afraid that if Texas were to become a state, Americans would clash again over the issue of slavery. So, Robert Merry says, both Martin Van Buren and Henry Clay spoke against bringing Texas into the Union.
And that was probably the right position from a standpoint of prudence, political prudence, or maybe diplomatic prudence. But it was the wrong position from the standpoint of where the American people were politically at that time.
In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west all the way to the Pacific Ocean and dominate the continent.
It's a very powerful concept, and it was not just a powerful concept, but it was a powerful impulse of America at that time.
As a result, Robert Merry says, many voters supported James K. Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Polk told voters he did not believe the federal government should have too much power. He said presidents and other elected officials might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But historian Robert Merry says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. After all, two presidents Polk admired, Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, had each served 2 terms. The nation's first president, George Washington, had also served 2 terms. Robert Merry says Polk's one-term promise was also a political bet. Polk wanted other Democratic politicians to support him. Polk thought that if he said he would be president for only 1 term, other politicians might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years instead of waiting 8.
And I suspect that he was probably right. And given the closeness of the election, I suspect that had he not made that one-term promise, he very likely would have been beaten by Clay.
As it was, the election of 1844 was extremely close. Wild campaign charges were made against both candidates. The Whig candidate, Henry Clay, was called a gambler, a duelist, a man of dishonest deals. Stories were told about his use of strong language and love of card games. On the other side, Whig newspapers reported that someone saw a group of slaves being sold in Tennessee. Burned into the skin of each slave, the papers said, were the letters JKP, the initials of James K. Polk. In the autumn of 1844, 2,700,000 Americans elected a new president. Polk defeated Clay by only about 38,000 votes nationwide. But Polk won 170 electoral votes to Clay's 105. President Tyler believed Polk's victory showed the American people wanted Texas to become a state. When Congress met in December, he proposed that both the House of Representatives and the Senate resolve to give Texas statehood. In a few months, they did. President Tyler signed the resolution on March 1, 1845, just 3 days before he left office. The resolution invited Texas to join the Union as a state. It gave Texas the right to split into as many as 4 more states when its population was large enough. Texas could keep its public lands, but it had to pay its own debts. And Texas could enter the Union as a slave state. The Mexican minister to the U.S. objected to the resolution. Mexico did not recognize Texas as an independent territory. The minister said making Texas an American state was an act of aggression against his country. He demanded his passport and returned to Mexico. Britain and France also sought to prevent Texas from becoming a state. They persuaded Mexico to agree to recognize Texas independence, but only if Texas would not join the United States. Texas thus had 2 choices. It could join the United States, or it could continue as a republic with its independence recognized by Mexico. The Texas Congress chose statehood. But the choice would come with a cost. The war between Mexico and the United States will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.